Good afternoon, everyone. This is the Senate Health Care Committee. It is Monday, May 18th. And colleagues, we are not going to be hearing House Bill 2934. We're rolling that over until Wednesday. But I know that Representative Lively's here, so I'm going to briefly open House Bill 3301. Representative Lively.
Thank you, Chair, member of the committee. My name is John Lively. I'm a state representative from House District 12, which is Springfield. I'm here today just to encourage your consideration and support of House Bill 3301. Along with you and many others, we've been working some time on access to health care, and especially access to health care from primary care physicians. And so from my standpoint, we've looked at a lot of different strategies, and we're still looking at strategies. This is just another one that I feel strongly about, provides an option. It's an option for people, and that would be able for naturopathic physicians to be able to be recognized and allowed to practice as a primary care physician if they so choose, and their license allows that. As a person, my personal experience is I've used a naturopathic physician for several years as my primary care physician. My insurance allowed that to occur and provided that, but not all of them in this case. And so what this bill does, if the physician, naturopathic physician, chooses to be recognized as a primary care and they meet all the requirements and the insurance providers and that, they can be a primary care physician rather than just, in many cases in the past, they've been recognized just as specialist. And this opens the door for hopefully a few more primary care physicians to be available for people to choose if they so choose.
All right, questions? All right, thank you.
Thank you very much.
We'll just temporarily close 3301 and open an informational on
newborn
screenings. Thank you. And who is signed it? Okay, yes, Katrina Hedberg, please. And colleagues, just to, we did have a bill very concerned about wanting to add another diagnosis to, or another, should I say, disease or condition to the newborn screening. So I that's why I have invited Katrina to tell us the process of how they determine what kinds of things are screened at when a newborn is born. Thank you.
Chair Motis Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, and members of the committee, I'm Dr. Katrina Hedberg. I'm the State Health Officer and State Epidemiologist with the Public Health Division of the Oregon Health Authority. And I'm going to talk a little bit about our Northwest Regional Newborn Screening Program. So what is newborn screening? Newborn screening is a process that began in the 1960s whereby every newborn gets screened for a variety of conditions that may not be evident at birth. It's a state-based public health program, and what that means is that even though there's federal guidelines, it's really up to different states to implement programs in those states and actually to pass laws and rules pertaining to what gets screened for. The conditions that get screened are ones that, for every newborn, are potentially harmful or fatal, but that might not be apparent at birth and become apparent later in either infancy or sometime later in life. Because there was a variety of practices that got put into place in the 1960s, in 2006, there was actually a national statute that got passed called the Newborn Screening Saves Lives Act. And part of this was to develop some national guidelines or standards by which newborn screening, again, conditions would be put onto the list. And this follows something that's also done. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force has put together clinical guidelines around preventive services, and they do this to examine what the evidence base is before adding things to the list. And some of the things that get looked at are, is there a practical laboratory test? Is it possible to test for it? Is there effective treatment? And is the disorder serious enough, are the things that are taken into consideration? So the Centers for Disease Control looks at a variety of things, and in they looked at the first decade of the 21st century and talked about newborn screening as being one of the 10 great achievements of public health for that decade. And I quote, improvements in technology and endorsement of a uniform newborn screening panel of diseases has led to earlier life-saving treatment and intervention for at least 3,400 additional newborns each year with selected genetic and endocrine disorders. And by April 2011, all states reported screening for at least 26 disorders on this expanded and standardized uniform panel. So just a quick overview, I'll talk about Oregon's statutory authority, the purpose and the process for newborn screening, and a brief overview of the regional program, and then talk specifically about the screening panel that we use here in Oregon, and then very briefly about the funding for this. So Oregon does have a statute, our newborn screening statute, 433.285, and this is just an abbreviated version, but it says, in the interest of public health and prevention of mental retardation, every infant shall be given tests approved by the Oregon Health Authority for detection of disease of phenylketonuria, or PKU, and other metabolic diseases. So what's important to note is that's the only one that's spelled out in statute, but it does specify these other metabolic diseases. And then the second point is the authority by rule shall specify those diseases for which infants shall be tested, the persons responsible for submitting specimens, methods of testing, and the manner of payment of fees. So what's interesting is that Oregon was actually the first state in the U.S. to mandate universal screening of infants for PKU, and that was in 1962. Okay, again, the purpose for screening is to identify asymptomatic. It's important they don't yet have symptoms, but who with prompt treatment can prevent severe disability or death. And that actually involves a very short screening window. It's usually done in the first few days to 2 or 3 weeks because many of these disorders, if they're not treated or intervened on early enough, kids will start to develop symptoms after that. Because of this, the samples have to be collected, submitted properly, tested, reported quickly, and they need to be acted upon. So it's more than just a test being performed. There's a whole process. So some characteristics of these screen disorders. Again, in Oregon, infants are screened for more than 40 disorders. If untreated, cause severe disability and or death, can be controlled if detected early, before the disease has developed. And many of them have a genetic basis for them and are also a result of a defective enzyme or part of a key metabolic pathway. So you're probably familiar with this. It's also called the HEAL stick. It's a blood specimen that's collected from every infant, a few drops onto this filter paper. And then the filter paper, as you can see, little pieces or samples of it are punched out, and those are what are tested. And those are that's the specimen that gets submitted to the public health laboratory. Now, the public health laboratory, this is a picture of the building. It's located out in Hillsboro. And there's a few things that are mandated for a public health laboratory to do. One of them is communicable disease testing that supports public health programs. For example, if there's an outbreak of foodborne disease, we would test specimens of those samples to figure out the organism, or the recent outbreak of meningococcal disease at University of Oregon, we're then responsible for testing to see how those are linked. We also have newborn screening, which I'm talking about now, as well as regulation of clinical and other environmental laboratories. So as I mentioned, newborn screening is not just the laboratory process or testing, but in fact it's a program, a public health program, that includes practitioner education, that's an important component, as well as information to parents, the laboratory testing, and then there's important tracking and follow-up, because obviously if one of these specimens gets collected and tests positive, we've got to be sure that we can identify who that infant is and get to those parents. And then there's medical consultation, and we do this in conjunction with Oregon Health and Sciences University. And we do have some of the parent handouts that are available for you also that we can see the information that we hand to parents. So this is a picture of the actual newborn screening laboratory. And this is the machine that punches out those blood spots. And I think it's really important that, again, one of the things that happened with the national guidelines or that act is that there was uniform standards put in place for the specimen collecting, processing, and testing to make sure that this was uniform in all states across the country. Now, the state of Oregon, our lab, we've actually operated a regional program since the 1970s. And we currently test all infants in Alaska, Oregon, of course, but Idaho, Hawaii, New Mexico, plus the Navajo Nation and civilian births on Guam. So our lab tests a total of 230,000 samples that are collected from 120,000 infants. Now, most infants get two samples, which is why one in the hospital and a second time at the postnatal visit. So that's why we have twice as many samples that are tested as infants. So how do we make a decision about what gets screened for? There's now a national evidence-based consensus process that establishes what are called the recommended uniform screening panel. And what happens, this is just a schematic, the disorder gets nominated to the Federal Advisory Committee on, it's the U.S. HHS advised secretary, the Advisory Committee on Heritable Disorders in Newborns and Children. And those disorders, once they're nominated, then they get evaluated by an independent panel of experts to determine whether there's an accurate and practical laboratory method and whether there's an effective treatment as well and whether the medical consequences are serious. And this is a transparent process and allows for public comment, so the public or other advocacy organizations can nominate disorders to this panel. If this committee votes to recommend addition to the nominated disorder, then it's forwarded, the committee forwards it to the Secretary of HHS for consideration. Currently, there are 29 disorders on the RUSP, and 12 of these have been nominated since the work began in 2008. Three of the conditions, critical congenital heart disease, severe combined immunodeficiency, and Pompe, were recommended favorably and then added to the committee. So again, this is part of the process. But there have been others that have not been recommended, and the final decision is still pending. So the categories of disorders, again, there's 29 conditions. Of those, the metabolic disorders, organic acid condition, fatty acid oxidation, amino acid disorders, and I mentioned PKU already. There are also endocrine disorders like hypothyroidism, hemoglobin disorders like sickle cell disease, and others such as cystic fibrosis. So these are examples of what are on the recommended panel. So this is a graph that you have in your handouts as well that talks about what Oregon has screened, what our laboratory has screened. There have been over 5 million infants since the program began in 1962, and of those, we've identified around 3,300 cases of disease. So overall, this is a significant disorder in one per every 1,500 births. Specific to Oregon, you can see that we've had about 2 million infants screened and a total of slightly over 1,200 abnormal conditions identified. So briefly, our newborn screening program is funded. The funding for it is paid for by fees that practitioners do. We have Oregon practitioners that order test kits, and it's 32 per one specimen kit, or again, you'll remember that each infant really needs two tests, one done in hospital and one done at the follow-up visit, so that would be $64 per two specimen kit. And then there's also similar, there's a three specimen kit for the neonatal intensive care unit, so infants that require a little extra testing or attention, if you will. Other states pay through contracts between that state public health agency and the Oregon Health Authority. So that's a brief overview of what newborn screening is and what we do, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
We have at least one per session of a parent wanting to have a new disorder screened. And see, this is why I wanted you to present this. So if someone comes to one of the legislators and said, we want the state of Oregon to screen this disease, my child has it, and the outcome would have been different if we had screened it. Could we send that condition to you and you let us know
where we at, has it been nominated before, and what the status is of that particular condition?
Yeah, Chair Mona Sanderson, thank you. Absolutely, we'd be happy to look at whether or not, because a lot of these, you know, obviously different states, people talk about, then it needs to be nominated to this, to the federal panel in order to make recommendations. So, but we would be able to tell you what the status of any particular condition is vis-a-vis the national recommendations.
And then the second question I have, are there states that put a disease on their screening list that hasn't been gone through the federal process?
Chair Mona Sanderson, as I mentioned, it's really a state-based program, which means that while the federal guidelines are around the recommendations, because that is what evidence-based, it's up to the states to pass either statute and or administrative rule that specifies the specific conditions. So, yes, there are some states that have adopted additional conditions above and beyond what the federal guidelines are. But, again, the federal guidelines look at the evidence-based. They also look at, or one of the things to consider really is when you add a new condition, what's the cost of that going to be, and is there a condition that, whether it's treatable. In other words, we want to be sure that if a condition is common enough, if you will, that infants get detected in a way that's treatable, and that the cost overall for that treatment, again, the newborn screening lab, we're going to have to raise fees once conditions are added to it. So it's a little bit of a checks and balances there.
Okay. So I know there was, I think, Krabber's disease that was a bill somewhere. Do you know anything about Krabber's
Senator Mona Sanderson, I think that is Krabbe's disease, and I'm not an expert in individual diseases. What I do know about that specific one is that the prevalence, it's about 1 in 100,000 infants, and my understanding is that unlike some of the conditions that have been added to the federal panel, that there is no specific treatment that is yet recommended. There are some proposed treatments, if you will, stem cell transplant that has a number of other complications once you give that. So again, this is at least at this point, again, I'm not an expert, but it's difficult to say that this particular disease is one that if it were diagnosed early, there's a known treatment, and that could happen in order to prevent some of the disability that happens with these kids.
So cost isn't a factor. And so if the legislature decided we would want to do that, it would be you would send a fiscal statement and show how much that would cost us.
As Chair Mona Sanderson, it does, these tests do cost, and so you're exactly right. We would need to be able to have a fee increase that would cover costs for additional tests.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Cruz.
I would say that the screening that we're now doing, and I think we're kind of state-of-the-art in Oregon on this. I have a nephew and a niece that are PKU kids who are going to be absolutely normal children who would have cost us a heck of a lot of money if they hadn't been detected.
Yeah, Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Cruz, that's absolutely. I mean, obviously, I'm a very strong believer in newborn screening. What I do think is that the national process for developing consensus and looking at what the evidence base is around what we screen for and whether or not it's treatable, that's something that we really is important for those of us in public health.
Yeah. Okay. I would say, Madam Chair, a rough definition of normal, they're high energy kids and they drive me crazy. But.
Thank you very much. Well, I think when next time that we get requests for that, we're going to send it down to you first and then talk with the proponents who want to have this added to our list, and then compare it and see what other, if our states, you know, to the north of us or south or east, or I guess west, cover it.
So, Chair Anderson, I would also suggest or recommend that those folks think about it at the national level and have it be nominated so that the review of the evidence around what's available for treatment inform the decision as to whether or not it gets added to the list.
And that's an easy process?
I don't know the exact process. Knowing at the federal level, my guess is it's not easy, but it's certainly possible, and they review this all the time. Dr. Mike Skeels, who used to be the head of the Oregon Public Health Laboratory before he recently retired, was actually on the subcommittee that looked at different conditions. So again, this is not, I'm sure it's not a, quote, easy process, but it's certainly possible, and it's being revised all the time.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Hedberg. I really appreciate it. With that, I'll close the informational hearing, and I'm not sure Representative Kenny Geyer is coming. Well, what I...
Rep Frederick's here.
Oh, here she comes. All right. I am going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2023 and 2948 and 2023. Yes.
Hi, Madam Chair and members of the Senate Health Committee. I'm Representative Alyssa Kenny-Geyer from House District 46, parts of Southeast and Northeast Portland. And I'm really honored to be here today in support of both House Bill 2948 and 2023. These were passed unanimously by the House Healthcare Committee and the full House. The bills were two of several bills that were brought to me by Jerry Gabay and Julie Majors, whom you may remember from your informational hearing last September. Jerry, who can't be here today, lost his only child, Susanna, to suicide at age 21 and has made it his life's mission to prevent this tragedy from happening to others. He is a member of the NAMI Oregon Board of Directors, co-chair of the Providence Health Systems Collaborative Council for Behavioral Health, and a co-author of the Oregon Psychiatric Physicians Association Suicide Prevention Checklist, for which he received the Oregon Psychiatric Association's Access Award in 2013. Fortunately, Julie, who is on a similar life mission, is here today. After her daughter attempted suicide twice at age 16, she joined the NAMI Multnomah staff, where she hears from many families about the experiences that are sadly too familiar. Suicide is a major issue in our state. For years, Oregon ranked between 7th and 9th in the country for suicides, but has been increasing since 2000 at a much faster rate than the national average. According to the most recent data from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, in 2010, Oregon had the second highest suicide rate in the country, and it's the second leading cause of death among Oregonians aged 10 to 24. In 2011, 685 Oregonians killed themselves, twice the number who died in vehicle crashes, and six times the homicide rate. In 2012, it climbed to 709. The financial cost is high. In 2010, hospitalization costs for self-inflicted injury exceeded $41 million. There are many challenges in filling the gaps of our fragmented mental health system, but one is making sure that we do a better job of reducing the revolving door in the emergency departments when people experience a mental health crisis. Another is a fear that providers have in disclosing information to those closest to patients when it is often critical to their care. This is especially important for adolescents and young adults who suffer from an especially high rate of suicide. Jerry's testimony on March 11, 2015, to the House Healthcare Committee was, quote, to make us aware of two things which may have saved Susanna's life, which might save others in the future, and which he believes are encapsulated in House Bill 2948 and House Bill 2023. The first item would be much greater communication between providers and caregivers by blood or affinity. At minimum, providers must be encouraged to seek authorization to communicate with appropriate supporters of the patient and then actually communicate. House Bill 2948, the HIPAA bill, attempts to do this. There is ample literature indicating that extensive communication is a best practice for therapy and suicide prevention, unquote. OCAP, the Oregon Council of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, states that communication between family members of persons seeking treatment for mental illness and health care providers improves the quality of care, reduces the risk of suicide and self-harm, and encourages the use of community resources to improve overall outcomes. Patients who are at least 14 years old may choose a family member or other support person as their lay caregiver. During a mental health crisis, when there is often a huge need for coordination, HIPAA, which is often misunderstood, actually does allow for communication in certain conditions. House Bill 2948 clarifies that the federal HIPAA privacy rule regarding conditions under which protected health information may be disclosed by a healthcare provider, sometimes without obtaining an authorization from the individual. The director of the Office of Civil Rights and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services issued a clarification of the HIPAA privacy rule in January 2013 following the Sandy Hook and Aurora mass shootings. The Oregon Department of Justice and Legislative Council both confirmed that House Bill 2948 is consistent with HIPAA and the privacy rule. The clarification enables continuity of care and clinically appropriate step-down treatments with engagement by family or friends as appropriate. We had very compelling testimony in support of the bill from Jerry Gabay, Julie Majors, Julie's daughter, and several other families. It is also supported by the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs and the Oregon College of Emergency Physicians. There are two amendments since we passed this unanimously. One adds back the civil immunity protection that was in the original draft and was removed without our noticing it during one of the amendment processes before it passed the House. And this is a really important, the civil immunity protection. There's already in the law civil immunity protection for not disclosing information. And this just balances it out and says as long as you're following HIPAA law, then you're protected from us from civil liability at the state level. Lori Freeman, of Legislative Council, did say that it's never really been tested whether the legislature granting civil immunity will be upheld by the courts, but we feel that it's very important if you've got one civil immunity protecting non-disclosure that you also have civil immunity protection for people who are following HIPAA. Again, this does not allow people to go beyond what HIPAA allows. That civil immunity protection is strongly backed by OPPA, which is the Oregon Psychiatric Physicians Association, as well as OCAP, the Oregon Council on Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. That's the dash four. The dash five names the bill after Jerry and Susan Gabay's daughter, Susanna Blake Gabay. I'm going to continue Jerry's testimony from March 11th, 2015. He said the second issue is that discharges from hospital care must be better coordinated with the resources in the community and with whatever support system the patient has. Communication must be robust rather than ignored, and the patient's support system engaged in the discharge process. House Bill 2023 is a giant step in that direction. It directs hospitals to adopt and enforce discharge policies for individuals that have been treated for mental health treatment. The policies must be publicly available and include at a minimum encouraging the patient to sign an authorization for the disclosure of information that is necessary for a lay caregiver to participate in the patient's discharge planning and to provide appropriate post-discharge support. And I want to just stop on the word encouraging for a minute because there's a continuum of everything from providing an opportunity for a patient to sign an authorization form to allow others to be a part of discharge. And then there's on the other extreme, it can be coercing or pressuring a fragile patient into, you know, identifying someone. And the word encouraging is meant to be in the middle there where it goes beyond just handing an authorization paper, but really talking through why it's really important when somebody leaves to have a support person or persons in the community that can help them if there's a relapse or help them get to appointments, so remind them of things like that and really be a part of the support process. There is no intention whatsoever in this bill to do any kind of pressure or coercion for people to sign that who do not want to sign that. the discharge policies must include discussing the patient's prescribed medications and the circumstances under which the patient or late caregiver should seek immediate attention. The discharge policies must also include a process to ensure coordination of the patient's care and a transition from an acute care setting to an outpatient treatment that may include community-based providers, peer support specialists, lay caregivers, or others who can execute the patient's plan following discharge. The dash 5 before you clarifies some minor issues brought up to me.
Now, wait, are you on 2020?
I'm on 2023.
Yes. Okay.
So this one also has an amendment that came after the House passed the full version. These were some issues that were brought to me by Providence right before we were right before our final chamber deadline, and so we decided to deal with them in the Senate. There's a couple minor kind of language and clarification changes. The one I want to highlight is the one at the end, the 7-day goal for a follow-up appointment on discharge. Since the 7-day goal is a CCO metric and is based on best practice, we want to ensure that hospital discharge policies aim for the same goal as the CCO system is doing. While the 7-day goal is not a mandate, it is clear legislative intent that this be a goal. Requiring documentation about why the 7-day could not be met will help ensure that the discharge staff work hard to find an appointment with 7 days, but it also allows for the fact that sometimes it's very hard to find provider availability, or perhaps there's someone on an 8th day that's an in-service provider, in-network provider, that they couldn't have on a 7th day, and that means that the patient might have to pay a lot more. So that may be in the patient's best interest, or there may be a facility that has a better fit for the patient, and that may be on 8th or 9th day instead of 7th day. So it allows some flexibility for the providers to do what's in the best interest of the patient. I appreciate input from consumers, mental health providers, insurers, hospitals, and the Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, who have also been working on the CARE Act to create discharge policies for mostly seniors who need help with post-discharge care. Again, both these bills passed unanimously. We've reached out very broadly for input about the amendments, and there seems to be broad agreement on the amendments, and I encourage your support. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Lou Frederick, representative from District 43, North and Northeast Portland. I guess I'm here not so much in terms of the details of the bill as to both of them, actually, 2948 and 2023, is to tell you, at least to give you a sense of why I began working on these things quite a while ago. In 1991, my wife began a process of every 3 to 6 months being in an emergency room or a hospital, a mental health ward usually there. I would arrive home, and I was never sure who I was going to be greeting. She would either be catatonic, or she would be non-communicative, or perhaps sometimes very combative. But it was every 3 to 6 months. And we would find ourselves in the hospital. When we got there, she would be there for 3 days to sometimes almost up to 2 weeks. The problem, though, is when she was released, I did not know what kind of medication she was taking, what kind of behavior I should be watching for, what to do if I saw anything, and who to talk with. Because depending on the hospitals, and believe me, we went to all of the hospitals in the metro area at one time, depending on the hospital and the people in charge of that particular ward, they would tell me or not tell me about what was going on. And the discharge issue was a significant one, because you're sitting there trying to figure out what's going to be best for your loved one, and you can't figure out what that is because no one's telling you things. This is an attempt to try to address that. Now, I should also tell you that as a result of the years that she's been working with this, she's been working with NAMI, and they had a good little walk yesterday. You couldn't come this time. and North Star, which is a clubhouse, what they call a clubhouse, she is also teaching peer support classes now to other folks who are struggling with this, and First Steps, where she goes into the hospital to suggest to those folks who are there how they can, what they can do once they leave the unit, and where they can get support. These are the kinds of things that are helping her a great deal. But I will say that it would have been a lot better for us as a family, and for me personally, to know what was going on with her, what medication she was taking, what I could do to help, what I should watch for, because believe me, every 3 to 6 months in a hospital, not a lot of fun. And even when she wasn't in the hospital, she was often struggling. She's doing relatively well right now, but I think this will help other families deal with these issues. So that's why I'm here, and I hope that you will support this legislation. Thank you.
Question. Thank you very much.
You gonna be able to get it?
So let's call up Jennifer Pepin, Julie, is it Maggers, and Cheryl Ramirez. And I think you signed up for both bills, so please.
Hello, Chair Mona Sanderson and Vice Chair Cruz and esteemed members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Pepin. I am myself diagnosed with bipolar, but today I'm here as the loved one involved in my fiancé's hospitalization after a suicide attempt this past summer. I urge you to pass House Bills 2948 and 2023 because I believe they will help people like us. When Chris was brought by ambulance to the emergency room, he said, "When I go home, I'm just going to do it again until I'm dead." Although this was said through the many pills he had swallowed, and he may not even recall making that statement, I believe had it not been for the proper treatment and planned out aftercare, it would have become our reality. Immediately with my arrival to the hospital, I was faced with having to advocate for Chris. He was left in a room in emergency with no clear plan of what steps were going to be taken. He was in no state to ask for assistance himself, and I couldn't get anyone to explain things to me, even though he had signed a release. After about 17 hours and my persistent inquiries, they finally told me they arranged for him to be transferred to an inpatient program. Not in his right mind, Chris, of course, wanted to come home immediately. He was on a hold and had no choice but to stay. However, once that was lifted, without notice to me, he said he was packed and ready for me to pick him up. At this point, he was not stable, had not been through any proper diagnosis, treatment, or therapy. I never spoke to a doctor, nor was I included in discussion of a discharge plan, and I began to panic at the thought of Chris coming home. My questions were, will he again try to end his life? What are the next steps? Is he just supposed to go home and fall into old routines that led him here in the first place? I told him that I would not let him come home unless there was a schedule mapped out, including all appropriate aftercare. It was only because of a friend and mental health advocate that I even had the strength or knowledge to say those things. I was wishing there was someone on the other end at the hospital who would be telling Chris the same things, but I had no idea what he was being told. Fortunately, after an adverse reaction to a new medication, Chris agreed to stay longer at the hospital. This gave us time to come up with something on our own for aftercare. Without speaking to his doctor, we wrote out the days of the week, and I made Chris outline what his daily recovery would look like, including doctor appointments and activities. I had nobody at the hospital guiding me if this was the right plan. Even when they eventually had a discharge plan, I was not part of that process, even though Chris had signed a release to involve me. I did not know what his discharge or aftercare plan included, and because of my lack of involvement, I was quite anxious about Chris's return. I had absolutely no idea whether he would follow my plan or if there was further information from the doctor I didn't know about. It would have been more appropriate for us to knowingly be giving Chris the same message. And remember, I myself live with bipolar disorder, so this lack of communication and coordinated planning was not healthy for either of us. I'm so grateful that 10 months later, Chris is doing very well. I believe that although the plan he followed was created on my own, it was following this regimented recovery plan that has made the difference for him. It would have made everyone involved feel much safer to have had the opportunity to work directly with the medically informed doctors who would have known more than I did. When faced with that situation, it is incredibly difficult to think straight, and had it not been for my friend's help, I would not have known what to ask or plan for. I know if roles were reversed, I would have wanted Chris to be involved in the discussion of my care and discharge. It is so important that there is a set standard to guide both doctors and families to accommodate the release of a patient from the hospital. Thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you so much for sharing your story.
Chair Mona Sanderson, Vice Chair Cruz, and esteemed members of the committee. My name is Julie Majors. I work for NAMI as a parent advocate and educator, helping parents learn how to navigate the system for their children and adolescents. And I'm also a parent. I have a 24-year-old, and my daughter will be 21 next week. At 16, she didn't believe she was going to make it to her 17th birthday. She had been struggling for 5 years in a downward spiral with untreated or undertreated depression and anxiety disorder. She was self-harming since middle school, and a lot of people were concerned, but we really didn't have very good direction on what to do with those concerns. When she was a junior in high school, she had been long enough in pain that she made an attempt on her life. She told me that she didn't really want to die, but she really couldn't live with the pain that she was in and no answers and no hope moving forward. So we ended up at the hospital. She became stabilized, and at discharge, she had been put on a new trial of medication, which I was concerned about, but I also didn't know any better myself and trusted the care and the expertise of the doctors. The doctor who prescribed the medication told her that he thought it was her best bet at feeling better. Little information was given to me about how to keep her safe or understanding suicidal ideation. And we essentially were told to go to our outpatient appointments and then back to school and try to make life as normal as we could, which we readily followed. But the following 2 weeks, my daughter didn't feel better. She actually felt worse. She had worse side effects, and her mind told her, the doctor told me this was my best bet at feeling better, and she attempted a suicide again. Back in the hospital, there was kind of a repeat process of stabilizing her, taking her off the medications, and then a discharge plan to send her home again with the same information that we had and the same plan to go to the outpatient providers that we were seeing. But I didn't feel that this was really adequate, and I was very frightened and traumatized at the time as well. So we insisted with a lot of support from knowing advocates and people who were case managers and folks that I knew from the work I was doing on health reform. I had a very sophisticated support network that coached me on what to say to whom and when. And we ended up, by the time of her second discharge, spending a 30-day residential stay and discharging from there, a very solid, coordinated care plan that was really meeting her needs much more. So she is doing well today. In September, my colleague Jerry Gabay and I were asked to testify and bring forward our stories. As you know from Representative Kenny Geyer, Jerry lost his daughter, and he presented information that he thought were practices that might have saved her life. And I can tell you that those very practices are indeed what saved my daughter's life, in so much as I was really able to insist that we move those practices forward. My daughter is doing very well today, and I thank God every day that that's the outcome that we've been able to have. I work with a lot of parents who don't know this journey, and they don't know the details of what to do and what to say. And I really urge the support of both of these bills. I think that they're going to go very far in making a difference and the work that we all do moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee. I am Cheryl Ramirez. I'm the director of the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs. And on behalf of the Community Mental Health Programs, the publicly funded mental health delivery system, we support both House Bills 2023 and 2948. We really strive for prevention of suicides and suicide attempts in the community with early intervention with individuals and their families. But when a person does get to the point that he or she is in the hospital in the emergency department, we believe strongly in warm handoffs between the hospital and the care coordinator. That's essential for their well-being. I don't usually give personal examples, but I feel compelled to say that I'm a family member of a person who attempted suicide, and I was extremely thankful that the crisis worker happened to find my cell phone number. I still don't know exactly how, but I found out. At the same time, I was extremely anxious and terrified when I found out that they released him with no one. He literally walked home from the emergency department that evening, and there was no care coordination whatsoever. I do have private health insurance, and that would bring me to a couple of other points I wanted to make, which is I believe there are gaps in care coordination among payers. It's not consistent. And I think that we need a consistent process for community members, regardless of their payer, of how they are covered or whether they're covered or not. And then secondly, in the future, I would like to see us apply the discharge policy to people who are not admitted to the hospital. For example, my loved one was not admitted to the hospital. He was just in the emergency department. So hopefully in the future, we'll add that. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you tell us a little bit more about the discrepancy amongst payers?
Well, for example, in Medicaid here in Oregon, coordinated care organizations have care coordinators, and they pay for care coordination. So whether that's by subcontracting to the community mental health program or, you know, I'm not sure if some CCOs have care coordinators on staff, but they actually pay for that service, and so it's a possibility. It's for someone to come to the emergency department and be able to literally take that person and help them, you know, when they go back to the community. That is not the case with all health insurance plans.
Thank you so much for your testimony.
Thank you.
To Adamson, Patio Sullivan, and Chris Bonif.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson with Providence Health and Services, and we are here in strong support of House Bill 2023 and 2948 with the amendments as described by Representative Kenny Geyer. We appreciate the courageous leadership of Julie and Jerry in bringing their stories forward and sharing them and working to improve the lives of those that struggle with mental illness. It's a priority for Providence to get this right and to work on discharge planning that is meaningful, that engages families and caregivers, and make sure that the folks that are in our care leave ready to take the next step in recovery and stabilize their loved ones and be able to move forward, getting to solid chronic management of what may be a chronic disease. We fully support the amendments, and particularly thank Representative Kenny Geyer in working with us on the Dash 5 to House Bill 2023 that makes some solid improvements in the bill. And thank you very much for the opportunity to share our support, and happy to answer any questions.
Chair Monis Henderson, Vice Chair Cruz. Members of the committee, I'm Chris Bonf here representing the Oregon State Chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and I can be very, very brief on this. Speaking just to House Bill 2023, NAMI's in favor of the bill with the Dash 5 amendments. Others have spoken more articulately than I can about the need for that legislation, and it would just point out that it's rare in our area of the world that we have this level of unanimity on any legislation dealing with mental health, and so very pleased to support this legislation and looking forward to working with the individual hospitals and the hospital association on developing many of the protocols that will assist families in dealing with inpatient psychiatric care. Thank you.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Patricia O'Sullivan. I represent the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. And I, too, am here today in enthusiastic support of both House Bill 2023 and House Bill 2948. House Bill 2023, the subject matter surrounding House Bill 2023 is it's very heartfelt. You've heard some stories here today. It's also something that's been very apparent to the psychiatric acute care psychiatric units in Oregon. There's 15 of them. Even though we have 60 hospitals, there's actually 15 acute care units where you go for a very short stay when you're acutely sick with a mental illness that has somehow, something has gone wrong. That is meant to be a short stay, and then you're supposed to move on to back home to another facility or for a long-term psychiatric help. Most of these folks come into our emergency rooms and spend a certain amount of time there. It's not supposed to be long, but in today's world, it ends up being longer than it should in a lot of times, a lot of cases. So the Hospital Association actually had a committee during the interim that worked on mental health issues. And we had two bills. One came through this committee and actually just passed out of the House committee today. And the other one was House Bill 3502, which did not get a hearing because we were told that we would be working on this in the interim. We want to be at that table because our front door issues, our back door issues, and our issues with the commitment process specifically are need help. We know that we can do a better job, especially in discharge planning, whether they're out of the emergency room going home or whether they're out of our acute care unit, either going to another setting, going home, or going to the state hospital. So we understand that. And this bill is ended up being a companion bill quite by accident to a bill you're going to hear on Wednesday, and that is the AARP bill of House Bill 3378. The AARP bill sets up a kind of a skeleton or an outline of discharge planning for everybody in our hospitals. Doesn't matter who you are, 2 days old, whoever you are. And then this bill, when it came about, we all worked very hard to make sure that it was a companion bill meant for those folks being discharged from our acute care psychiatric units, or they could be up on a med-surg floor. They could be wherever, with a mental illness. It doesn't have to be there. But when they're leaving, this would be a companion bill. So you'd have to do this for everybody. In addition, you do this for those being treated for a mental illness. Does it go far enough? You know, probably not. It was a really good negotiated compromise, I think, and I hope everybody thinks, for now. And I believe there will be much more work done on this. In fact, the head of our OPIC unit, or our OPIC Council, which is the Oregon Psychiatric Inpatient Council that has the director of all 15 acute care units, it meets monthly at the association. The chair of that council and Mr. Bonaf are getting together with others and creating protocols to fit the outline of the discharge planning. In other words, you don't want to put everything protocols in statute, but this is where they're building a set of protocols, and we'll get those to every one of our acute care units and our other hospitals for discharge planning. Again, we're very supportive. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Seeing none, thank you very much, panel. We'll be bringing them back when the amendments come. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2948 as well as House Bill 2023, and we're going to go back to House Bill 3301, and I would like to call up Jeff Clark, Phil Donovan, and Tom Holt.
Good Good afternoon. I'm Chairman Mark Anderson and committee. My name is Dr. Jeff Clark. I'm a naturopathic physician providing primary care in Tualatin, Oregon, where I am a clinic co-owner with two other doctors. Previously, I worked in Oregon High Tech and also have a degree in computer science from Montana State University. I'm the first ND to be a member of the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Committee that supports the Oregon Health Policy Board informing the Oregon Health Authority. I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 3301 on behalf of the Oregon Association of Naturopathic Physicians, where I'm a board director. On January 1, 2014, provider type non-discrimination law came into effect from the federal government, and we've seen a lot of benefit in there being better access to naturopathic doctors on most health plans. I provided in written testimony a brochure on ND scope of practice in Oregon and the Patient Protection Act. So something else happened at the same time. Several of the major private health insurers suddenly decided that naturopathic doctors were specialists and gave us a unilateral declaration of this and didn't provide a path for us to be able to credential to be a primary care physician. We can already credential with the Oregon Health Authority. We've had other credentialing with CCOs and then also the Oregon Health Co-op. So there were three problems with this practice. First is that naturopathic doctors train and graduate with a skill set that's really aimed at providing primary care. Oregon statute currently forbids NDs from calling themselves specialists. So we were put in a position where we're juxtaposed with our own licensing law. But the real issue is that it provides financial and access barriers to patient care. When you're a specialist, co-pays are often twice as high than if you're to be a PCP. And also, these same insurers were also disallowing coverage for essential health benefits when they're provided by a naturopathic doctor acting in the primary care role. This would include well woman visits, physical exams, childhood vaccinations. And then the most perplexing for me, since I provide primary care, is, and I added testimony from one of my patients, Mr. Jackwith, is that people would have to go to a different PCP in order to get a referral to come to see me for primary care. So it just didn't make very good sense from a patient point of view. So House Bill 3301 would require private health insurers to allow naturopathic doctors a credentialing pathway to become a PCP. I've provided also my written testimony, a statement that our board, Oregon Association of Naturopathic Physicians, has adopted as our official policy and what we think is good criteria. That pretty much comes directly from what the Oregon Health Authority is already utilizing to credential both naturopathic doctors, medical doctors, and nurse practitioners. In terms of the other parts, coordination of care. So we also, on this bill, we would like to, we have it removing the prohibition against us being called specialists. So if we're not going to be able to primary care, then I guess that's the alternative. And it fulfills the Healthcare Workforce Committee, which this five-year plan preceded my participation in that, but to remove insurance access barriers to NDs so that we can help fulfill the or fill the shortage of primary care providers that we have in the state of Oregon. So please support this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Phil Donovan, here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Naturopathic Physicians. Just a couple of things. There were some concerns raised at, about the initial legislation as introduced. So our association sat down with insurance carriers, the Board of Naturopathic Medicine, other provider groups to amend the bill. Basically, we did a few things. First off, we added the requirement that NDs who are applying to be credentialed as a primary care physician must meet the insurer's credentialing requirements. And to that end, our association had already drafted up, and this has been submitted to the record, credentialing criteria, and this aligned very neatly with the expectations of carriers that we worked with on this legislation. As Dr. Clark referenced, the Oregon Board of Naturopathic Medicine brought to our attention that there was an old law in the books said you couldn't declare yourself as a specialist, which was kind of ironic since we were being categorized as such. So that is being removed with their support. And finally, we sat down with the Oregon Medical Association. And in the initial legislation, the term primary care had been included in our scope. And as this committee is well aware, anytime you say scope, them's fighting words, and so they asked us to remove them, and we said no problem. It's probably a conversation that the term primary care is found throughout Oregon statute, work groups, et cetera, and everything's got a little bit of a different definition to it. It's something that we should dig into perhaps in the interim, but not for today. We amended it out of the bill. I think we bring it forward now without any stakeholder opposition. Urge your adoption. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt with Cambia Health Solutions. Pleased to be here in support of House Bill 3301A. We're very supportive of the role of naturopathic physicians. In fact, one of our executives sits on the board of the Naturopathic College in Portland. And we're happy to be able to work with Phil and with Dr. Clark in just making some, I think, largely technical tweaks to the original bill so it could, move forward and accomplish the goals that we all share of making sure that people can have good access to naturopaths.
Great. Questions? All right. I'd like to move the bill today. Is that all right? Okay. I will close public hearing on House Bill 3301 and open a work session on House Bill 3301.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3301A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 3301 to the floor with due pass recommendations. Any discussion? Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just in an abundance of caution, I just want to declare a potential conflict. My wife is a nurse practitioner who employs doesn't employ, but is in partnership with some naturopaths who may be affected by this bill.
Thank you so much. It's so noted for the on the record. Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Excused.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries, and I'll close the work session on House Bill 3301. And the carrier, I'll carry it. And I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2696.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2696 defines delegated entity as the dental care organization, mental health organization, or similar organizational provider. It directs the Oregon Health Authority to conduct annual external quality reviews of each coordinated care organization to notify all coordinated care organizations of the information about delegated entity. If OHA has contracted with a contract review organization, it directs OHA to provide all the coordinated care organizations with information from the delegated entity. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Josh Balick and Ashlyn Strong.
Members of the committee, for the record, Josh Balick representing the Coalition for Healthy Oregon, or COHO. COHO is an organization that's made up of members who work with 8 of the 16 CCOs in the state of Oregon. Before you is 2696, and it comes to your committee with a unanimous vote out of the House. 2696 is an attempt to try to reduce and cut down some of the burdensome and duplicative audits and the auditing process that is currently going on inside the Oregon Health Authority of the CCOs and a lot of our subcontractors. Many of our CCOs have to often spend hundreds of hours basically resubmitting the exact same information over and over again. And this is an attempt to try to streamline that process. The bill clarifies that the Oregon Health Authority shall make information available to the CCOs that contract with entities that make up the auditing process much less burdensome for all the parties involved, including the OHA, which actually this could end up reducing their auditing responsibilities as well over the long run. Not only does it help our CCOs, but it also helps to reduce the work for some of our subcontractors who manage many different other or work with many other CCOs. So a good example would be a DCO like Advantage Dental who contracts with all 16 CCOs. The OHA will come and ask one CCO for information for Advantage, and then they go to another CCO and ask for the exact same information for the same Advantage over and over again. So this would help reduce that by basically creating a place where we can actually see what's been submitted and then not having to do it over and over again. not having to spend valuable time and resources on duplicative audits is essential for the CCOs if they are to stay on the mission of reducing or improving our healthcare system. There are a few clarifications that need to be made in the current bill to make sure the true intent is met. We've been working with our other CCOs, dental care organizations, and the OHA to get the language just right. We have one last tweak, so hopefully we should have that ready for you guys as early as Wednesday. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Great. Ashlyn.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ashlyn Strong with HealthShare of Oregon, a coordinated care organization serving over 240,000 Oregon Health Plan members in Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington counties. While we support the bill and agree with Mr. Ballack's testimony, this is not a top priority for HealthShare, but we wanted to make sure to put on the record our appreciation for Representative Nathanson's leadership on administrative simplification for the coordinated care organizations as well and beyond for other issues. And also, over the last few days, we had some new and unexpected concerns that were raised with this bill that required us to quickly work on some amendment language. So we wanted to thank Chair Monis Anderson and Ms. Rockowitz for adeptly guiding us through that process over their last few days and getting us to this point where we're very close to being able to support the bill as amended and move forward.
Now, it's my understanding that OHA would like maybe another, we have the Dash 5s that we're working on, and then there's possibly another amendment coming. Is that right? So we may be just having another amendment, too.
Yes.
Yep. All right. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2696 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3343A.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3343A requires insurers that cover prescription contraceptives to reimburse healthcare providers or dispensing entities for 3 months' supply of contraceptives and for a 12-month period after the initial 3-month period. There's a Dash A3 amendment which modifies when insurers cover prescription contraceptives. It requires reimbursing healthcare providers or dispensing entities for dispensing contraceptives for a 6-month period. The insured has been on the drug for at least 6 months. The prescription specifies the supply of 6 months or more. The insured obtains a new prescription at least once during the 12-month period, and a copayment for the 6-month supply is no more than twice the amount of copayment for a 90-day supply. There's no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
Great. Dr. Sky Frome, C.C. Patton, and Mary Nolan.
Chair Monis Anderson and the committee, my name is Dr. Sky Frome, and I'm a family nurse practitioner at Planned Parenthood Columbia Willamette. I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 3343, which will provide greater access to birth control and reduce the rate of unintended pregnancy in our great state. Since 1963, PPCW has successfully carried out its mission of providing, promoting, and protecting access to quality reproductive and sexual health care. Each year, approximately 60,000 women and men visit one of PPCW's health centers. We do more to prevent unintended pregnancy than any other organization in the state. I have worked in our health centers for over 7 years and have talked to thousands of women regarding their contraceptive needs. I have seen firsthand how removing barriers to access can improve women's lives. Currently, the Oregon Contraceptive Care Program provides patients with a 12-month supply of birth control at one time, but private insurers only provide reimbursement for 30 to 90 days. House Bill 3343 would require all private health insurance carriers provide reimbursement for a 12-month supply of birth control at one time. Studies show that dispensing a greater supply of contraception at a clinical visit is associated with fewer repeat visits, greater contraceptive continuation, and a reduction in the odds of unintended pregnancy. A study done at the University of California, San Francisco, shows the rates of unintended pregnancy and abortion decrease significantly when women receive a 1-year supply of oral contraceptives. Researchers observed a 30% reduction in the odds of pregnancy and a 46% decrease in the odds of an abortion in women given a 1-year supply of birth control. According to the Guttmacher Institute, inconsistent use of contraception accounts for 41% of unintended pregnancies. Making contraception more accessible not only reduces the incidence of unintended pregnancy and abortion, but it also saves money, according to the researchers. If the 65,000 women in the analysis who received either one or three packs of pills at a time had experienced the same pregnancy and abortion rates as women who received a one-year supply, almost 1,300 pregnancies and 300 abortions would have been averted, according to the team. Women take their birth control needs seriously. I commonly see patients who have gone out of their way to come back for their birth control refill, whether it is scheduling appointments on their school break or taking time off work. For patients who receive a 12-month supply, we have seen numbers from the C-Care program that show that women do not waste their birth control. Data from over 50,000 patients who received a 12-month supply of contraception showed that only 1.2% of clients received more than a standard supply. Not only have numerous studies shown the benefits of 12-month dispensing, but it also reduces barriers for women all over Oregon. Rural Oregonians often have long distances to travel and cannot make it to the pharmacy on a monthly basis. Others may not have a confidential mailbox where they feel safe having their birth control delivered. Whatever the reason, we believe that there should be no barriers to consistent and effective birth control use. We also know that it is in the best interest of insurers to keep costs down, and this bill will reduce costs. The average commercial insurer payment for all maternal and newborn care ranges from $18,000 to $28,000. The average hormonal birth control costs range from $100 to $600 per year. By preventing just one unintended pregnancy, an insurer will save a minimum of $17,400. This is enough savings to pay for 29 additional years of contraception. As a health professional, I know this issue is about lowered costs and best practices, but I also know the real-life impact it will have for patients I see every day. I came to testify on this bill today because, as a provider, it is frustrating to me to have to treat patients differently depending on their insurance. I meet with women every day who are ecstatic to finally receive a supply of birth control that allows them to manage their lives in the most healthy and responsible way possible. When I have to restrict access to something as effective as birth control to certain patients and not others simply because of their insurance coverage, it goes against all my medical and ethical education and training. This committee has a chance to fix that. Improving access to contraceptive methods reduces unintended pregnancy and helps women to plan their families. Please join me in supporting House Bill 3343. Thank you.
My name is Cece Patton, and I'm here as a young woman in support of HB 3343. I began taking birth control a year ago to ease pain associated with my menstrual cycle, and I anticipate that I will be taking contraceptives for the better part of the next 30 years. I am a junior in high school, and I already know that the world expects a lot out of my generation. I'm a good student, and I work hard. I study hard so that I can graduate high school and get into a good college. I'm the captain of my varsity lacrosse team, and I have practice every night, often until 10 p.m. On the weekends and days after school that I don't have practice, I work at my part-time job. I set my alarm every morning for 4 a.m. to get up and take my birth control because it's supposed to be taken at consistent times, and my schedule is so hectic that that is the only time I know that I will be the same place at the same time. I have to get my refill every 90 days, and I am able to have the refill mailed to me. But even remembering to order in enough time to make sure I don't miss a day is sometimes a challenge. If I do miss a day, my menstrual cycle causes me a lot of pain, and it negatively impacts my education. Something as important and effective as birth control should be just a little bit easier to get. Many of my friends who take birth control don't have the same mail options. One young woman I know has to refill her birth control every 30 days. If she wants to get an additional 60 days, she has to pay out of pocket. There's not a mail delivery option, so her mother has to go to the pharmacy and pick up her birth control monthly. And it isn't available at consistent times. Sometimes the pharmacy calls her a week in advance, but sometimes they call her just the day before she needs it. When that happens, her mother has to leave work early and pick it up so she can start it the very next day. My friends and I are just a small sampling of the 99% of women that would take birth control at some point in their lives. For birth control to be effective, consistency is essential. For many women, whether they are working multiple jobs or living in remote rural areas of the state, receiving only 30 or 90 days of contraception at a time can be an obstacle to effective use. A 30 or 90-day supply also does not adequately serve the needs of women without access to transportation and doesn't even serve many college students or others who do not reside in one place. For something that almost every single woman will be on at some point in her life, dispensing a 12-month supply just makes sense. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, my name is Mary Nolan. I am here today as Interim Executive Director of Planned Parenthood Advocates of Oregon. Thanks for the chance to testify in favor of House Bill 3343A. Madam Chair, I am mostly here to respond to issues that perhaps might be raised by the next panel, but let me just say in advance that one of the concerns we have heard some people might have about this bill is the likelihood that it could create a precedent, and I wanted to address that proactively. And I'd like to address it in four quick ways. First, the legislature in general and this committee in particular have a clear track record of discerning appropriate limits for health policy. You have in numerous ways demonstrated that you can establish policy law in one area without establishing similar law in another area. You've judiciously extended prescription authority to nurses and psychologists for some medicines, but not for all, obviously exercising your discretion, the role of the committee. You've carefully identified certain diagnostic tests that must be covered while not including all diagnostic tests. You've differentiated the licensing standards for various healthcare professionals. Indeed, you've established different policy for different types of prescription drugs. So setting a 12-month standard for dispensing of contraceptives, as this bill suggests, is well within the discretion that the legislature and this committee routinely exercises. Secondly, there is clear medical and public health basis for the specific practice proposed in 3343A. The research shows significant health benefits to patients who receive 12-month supplies, significant cost savings to insurers as well as patients, and significant public health benefit in moving the state to further reducing the rate of unintended pregnancies. We are not aware of any medical research that would argue for a different level besides 12 months. Third, contraceptives are indeed unique, as you've already heard, and I won't repeat that. 98% of sexually active women will use contraception at some point in their lives, many of them for decades at a time. That clearly distinguishes it from other drugs and gives you the basis on which not to establish a precedent if you move forward with the recommended policy here. And finally, unintended pregnancy is such a significant issue for women and such a significant systemic cost to hit on the healthcare system that it should be treated differently than other medicines. All of these argue that you can move forward with the policy recommended in 3343A and require 12-month dispensing without creating any precedent for any other medicines or prescriptions. I am available after the next panel if you would like me to address any other concerns that might get raised. Thank you for your support.
I just want to ask some questions about storage, and so it'll be to Nolan and probably the doctor. I had my staff just late this morning pull up how to store the pill, and I was amazed at what we need to do to maintain the integrity and efficacy of a pill. I didn't realize that keeping them in the bathroom cabinet or in your purse may be one of the worst choices for storing the pill. Temperature is critical, humidity is critical, and so that's, and I'll go through all of it and then you respond. The because of the increase in temperature and humidity, the bathroom isn't a good place. Okay, they say store them, according to the sheet that I got, store them in the hall or in a kitchen, but not directly above the stove. Also, storing them in summer or winter, if you're going on a trip, you shouldn't have them exposed to extreme heats or cold, because they can alter the hormones on how they're delivered into the body. So on the rack on your car or in the hold of an airplane, they do not recommend that at all. Keep them with you. If you have 12 packs, that would be a little bit hard, but still, these are issues that I want us to address a little bit. When you go on backpacks, which I did when I was first married, didn't realize that I could have had my pill ineffective because we went snow camping all the time, and we're in extreme cold, but we dressed for it. But so could you just maybe address storage and what type of education you actually give to people so that they truly will understand that how you store 12 months of pills is extremely important?
Certainly. I know that, yes, probably extreme temperatures are important, but I would also say that women are extremely responsible with their birth control. I know that many other medications that people take, whether they're prescription or over-the-counter, are also very dependent on temperature and dosing and timing, and women are able to manage this and other medications, particularly over-the-counter medications. On each package of birth control, there are very specific temperature guidelines that are there. I also know that written information that they get from pharmacists and from clinics like mine, where they're dispensed their supply in the clinic, include information about storage. There is a method of birth control called the NuvaRing, which is temperature sensitive, much more temperature sensitive than a birth control pill. And it is specifically, every patient is asked, are you able to store this in the appropriate way? And then also instructions are given on what to do if somehow that were to vary. But I do agree, while there are temperature guidelines in which to keep your birth control, it's something that women don't take lightly and are very similar to other medications that people take every day.
Great.
Madam Chair, and this would be for Doctor. Can you tell us how long Planned Parenthood has been dispensing at 12 months and any type of challenges you've seen in your everyday practices, or has it been working fine?
I've been with Planned Parenthood for 7 years, and as long as I have been there, I know that depending on funding, the funding that allows us to dispense a 12-month supply, that has been the norm since I've worked there. Sometimes there are payer issues, but that hasn't changed. As far as supply goes, it's definitely something that I know sometimes someone is trying something new, because sometimes you have to try different types of contraception. Every woman is different, and certainly there are patients who keeping something in the refrigerator or keeping something in a very specific temperature is not appropriate, and so then they may come to me and say, let's find a better birth control that works for your lifestyle. And sometimes they need to take it for several months to decide, and I routinely ask patients, would you like to take several months or would you like to take the entire year? And the vast majority of patients would rather take home a supply of birth control that isn't 100% perfect for them, rather than risk becoming pregnant because they don't have access to it.
Thank you
very much. Let's call up Elise Brown. Oh, Representative Parrish is here. Any other legislators? Okay.
Thank you. Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, Julie Parrish, House District 37, Westland and Tualatin. I was one of, I think, maybe there were two of us who voted no on this bill on the floor as it came over. And I come from a family where I was the only person to not have a baby out of wedlock, to not be pregnant as a teenager, and have seven brothers and sisters who all had were pregnant by 19, and probably some of them couldn't afford to have children. So I am very sensitive to the issue around contraceptives and access to contraceptives. But I was still a no, and I want to share with you why I have concerns about the bill as it was written. I feel a little more comfortable with the Dash 3 amendments that put a 6-month, would still actually like to see it be 90 days. And really it has to do with healthcare costs. So in the original bill, if I was to walk in and get a prescription for a 3-month trial of a formulary and then be further dispensed 3 months later, a 12-month, and then somewhere about month 6 change my mind and make a new choice, whether that is switching to a different type of contraceptive pill or making the decision to go to an IUD or some other form of birth control, theoretically you're going to have more calendar months dispensed than months there are in a year. So in the case of switching formularies one time mid-year, you actually could have 30 months under the original bill dispensed in a calendar year. And as we look at healthcare costs, particularly given what's coming forward with the Affordable Care Act, one of the things that I'm tracking and was still waiting on LC for a bill for is how do we as a state look at the cost of what's going to happen under the ACA in 2018 with the Cadillac tax, the excise tax. You know, for my school district alone, if they made no changes, that tax is going to be a $1.1 million hit to their budget. And so when we look at that and apply that out across all public employees, I just got the numbers for TriMet today, how much they're paying for health care and what that tax is going to look like for them. I question driving the cost of health care even for convenience. And I've been on birth control pills at different times in my life and used other methods of birth control as well. Anymore, you can get meds shipped to your house. So the issue of rural concern, and I've lived in Southern Oregon and certainly had rural concern, still had access to birth control when I lived down there. You know, there's a pharmacy on every corner. I question whether or not asking either a self-insured like the state of Oregon or an insurance company to incur the cost and bear the cost of dispensing more months than someone can possibly use in a year is good fiscal policy. So while I absolutely urge us to find ways to increase access to birth control, I supported the concept of having it dispensed by the pharmacy. I think that's a great idea. I do question the wisdom of driving health care costs unnecessarily, and I do see that this bill does that as it's written. Like I said, feel a little more comfortable with the 6-month limitation in the Dash 3, but there is no other formulary. I could make the same argument for statins or the blood pressure med that I take to say, hey, please give it to me for 12 months. We don't have any other formulary that we currently do this for in state statute that I am aware of, but I really do just caution us to think about all of the different types of bills, this one included, that incrementally are going to drive our health care costs and what we're going to have to come back and be faced with in a subsequent biennium around those increased costs. So I would support the Dash 3s a lot more comfortably than I do the underlying bill, but I do want you to keep that in mind as we look at the overall delivery cost of health care and what that's going to do for our budgets. So that's why I was a no, and I'm an unusual no vote on that, given my personal support for access to birth control, but the financial hit could be significant for us.
Thank you so much, Representative Parrish. Questions for her? Thanks so much for testifying. Okay, Elise Brown, Jessica Adamson, and Betsy Earls. I guess we have enough room for three.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Elise Brown, for both LifeWise Health Plan of Oregon and for AHIP, America's Health Insurance Plans, National Trade Association. And to be clear, here in support for all of AHIP members, all my Oregon members, and I'll mention them, MOTA, Kaiser, HealthNet, Pacific Source, Cambia, and Providence. You'll hear from Jessica in just a minute. Let me start by clarifying that our opposition is not about contraceptives or birth control. In fact, far from it. I speak as Elise Brown. I'm one of the statistics. Use birth control starting at, I think, 18 or 19, and I'm 57 now. And I understand how critical birth control is. It helped me avoid unwanted pregnancies, and it also was very helpful when I did make the decision to start my family, that I could do so in a coordinated fashion and help me get two great kids 3 years apart. One of them is sitting right in the back of the hearing room as I speak. But to be clear, our opposition is in what the bill does, 3343A, in its requirement of health plans to pay up front for 12-month dispensing of prescription contraceptive. You all need to know that there is not a, and this is in the world of private insurance, that there's not a single prescription drug on the market now that is dispensed at 12 months, and there's reasons for that. AHIP and its members support increasing access to birth control, but 12 months is bad policy, sets a horrible precedent for all prescription drugs, not just contraceptives, and it's going to lead to increased costs. What we are here to offer today, and I'm going to let Jessica get into the particulars about it, but we are offering the Dash 3 amendments, and you heard Representative Parrish allude to that. And it's a way, I think we feel strongly, that it's going to achieve the very same goals, greater access to birth control, without adding the risk and the cost. So it's a six-month dispensing after you've been on for 6 months. So you're reducing those visits, unlike maybe my peers and I sitting at the table who used to have to go and pick up our meds 12 times a year. This will trim it down to two visits a year. So we think the access is going to be greater. It's 6 months, and that's something that we can support. And I'll let Jessica with Providence add on that.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson here today with Providence Health and Services. And we are here in support of increased access to contraceptives. We absolutely agree with the proponents that anything we can do to reduce unintended pregnancy and help women lead the kind of healthy reproductive lives that they choose is very important, and it is certainly our goal at Providence. And so we, as a major provider of women's health care services in this state, believe that extending access to six-month dispensing is through the Dash 3 amendment is particularly important because of precedent reasons. And I very much appreciate the proponents trying to establish why contraceptives are different. However, this session and so many more, as I spent my time in and around the legislature, what we found is that pretty consistently legislation builds on each other. And so to say that for certainty that this is one class of drugs and there will never be the argument that this should be extended to something else, I think for us, we have seen the contrary to that, that there is a building effect, and we are very concerned about generally the cost of prescription drugs. Contraceptives are a different class, but what we would say is that we see precedent setting all the time, and to set a 12-month dispensing precedent for all drugs, or the potential for expansion even piece by piece for different conditions and different drugs, would add a tremendous expense, as the single fastest growing cost of healthcare is pharmaceutical drugs. We see, regardless of whether it's specialty drugs or generics, we are seeing tremendous cost increases, and we have talked about this ad nauseum in front of this committee before, but it is a real concern. And so as we look at 3343, we are concerned about precedent setting. That said, we do recognize that increased access to birth control is in everyone's interest, women, men, everybody. And so we do support the Dash 3 amendment that takes a tremendous leap forward in ensuring increased access to make sure that, women are stable on the drug for 6 months and then allow for 6 month dispensing. And we believe that by doing that, we're able to, make sure that women have access to the drug on a regular basis, but B, kind of reduce the risk of establishing precedent over the long term. And so we would encourage the committee's favorable consideration of the Dash 3, again, in the interest of moving forward on expanding access to a very important drug for women.
Madam Chair, can I jump in? Because I'm going to have to get going shortly to pick up my daughter. But I was, I just hope that we'll go where the science leads us. And my understanding is that the literature shows that 12 months really provides us the best bang for the buck. And one thing I'd be interested if, and you might not have this now, but if you could tell me how much a year's worth of contraception would cost compared to one unintended pregnancy, and what kind of balance cost for the insurance side of your business might be. And then lastly, Madam Chair, it would be great if we could hear from Mary Nolan again to just discuss some of the claims before I go.
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, I'm more than happy to get our cost data on what a year's supply of birth control would be against one unintended pregnancy. I want to be very clear that the argument that I'm making isn't about whether there's a sufficient ROI on a 12-month dispensing of contraceptives. That is not the argument that I'm making today. It is truly about precedent setting and the cost implications of having different classes of drugs build on the precedent established today. So I just want to be super clear. I am not trying to make an argument that that there is lack of sufficient data around return on investment for a 12-month dispensing. It truly is a precedent issue that is concerning.
Other questions? Thank you very much. And Marcia Kelly, Jan Meekins, and B.J. Kavanaugh.
And me.
Oh, I forgot.
Sorry.
We missed you.
That's okay.
I usually don't let questions go until we hear the panel. Sorry. Right. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries. AOI represents approximately 1,600 businesses, both large and small, across the state. And those businesses employ roughly 200,000 employees. Most of our members provide some form of private health insurance to their employees to the extent that we can. But as I know that you're aware, in this committee especially, that's becoming ever more costly. So anytime that you are looking at new requirements for health insurance or changes in the way prescription drugs are dispensed, new mandates, anything like that, we really ask that you keep in mind that the costs that you're imposing that look like they may be on insurance companies are basically passed straight through to the employers that are paying the premiums in the commercial market. So, you know, anytime something costs an insurance company more, really it costs, the business community that's paying those premiums more. And we would ask that you look at bills such as this in light of that. 3343 is, you know, I think specifically written to contraceptives right now. But really, we see it as bad policy decision for any prescription medication dispensing. That said, I think we would feel much more comfortable with the Dash 3s. But just in terms of some examples of where a bill like this could drive up costs, not just in terms of contraceptives, but when it extends, as we see that it probably will, to other types of medications. You know, if a patient, once a 12-month supply is dispensed, if a patient loses or discontinues use of their prescription drug, the insurance will have to pay for the replacement or the new method. According to claims data from one of our member insurers, only about half of birth control users, if we're just speaking specifically to contraceptives, stay on the same product for a year. And about 16% of regular users switch birth control methods at least one time in the course of the year. These are things that will cost, I think, you know, our insurance carriers money, and those costs, again, are passed straight through to us. And, you know, I would point out just from the health standpoint of our members, any prescription drugs are not harmless. You know, not one of them is, and they're not always effective for a particular person. When refills are infrequent, you really cut down on the opportunity for the pharmacist or the doctor to clinically monitor and review a patient for adverse side effects and increase the opportunities for harm to go unchecked. So we would support your favorable consideration of the Dash 3 amendments. We'd feel comfortable with those, but at 12 months, not necessarily to contraceptives, but to prescription drug dispensing as a whole, we're in opposition to the bill.
Thank you.
Can I ask one more question? I wanted to pick up on the notion that if somebody loses their 12-month supply, that they would automatically get a new one. My experience is when I lose my medication, I'm on the hook for it. I have to pay for it out of pocket until the next cycle comes around. Are you sure about that, Betsy, or do you think you might have misspoke?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, I'm sure I didn't misspeak, but perhaps I applied it more broadly than it should have been. I know that my own insurance company has paid for things for me when I've lost them. So,
Jessica, what's going
maybe
on?
Maybe some of both, right? She's not my insurer.
All right, thank you. I would like some clarification on that somehow, if perhaps the proponents or opponents could send some information to the community administrator.
We'll do that.
Maybe they're just being nice.
I don't know.
Okay. B.J. Kavanaugh said he does not want us to testify. That's good. Jan Meekums. But he does say he supports the bill. Jan Meekums and Marcia Kelly. And let's make it brief.
It'll be very brief. Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jan Meekums. I'm the state director for NFIB, National Federation of Independent Business. We have about 7,000 members in Oregon, small, private, independently owned businesses, and about 350,000 members nationwide. We have been surveying our members since 1973, and consistently, one of the biggest concerns for them is the cost of health care. And to support what's happening for our small businesses in healthcare, the comprehensive survey was done in 2014 by the National Small Business Association, and they found that the average monthly per employee cost of health insurance was for a small firm was $1,121. We asked in 2009 for the estimated monthly cost. At that time, it was about $590 per employee. Plus, the employers reported an additional $458 per month in other various costs per employee. And a 91% reported that they expected their health insurance costs to increase in the coming year. So we are opposed to 3343 as it's written, just from the viewpoint that we see it as a cost driver and that it will increase insurance premiums. One for one, a year's worth of contraception is certainly cheaper than the birth of an unwanted child. But of course, that's not going to be the case. We're not going to have huge numbers of women having children as a result of decreasing, not going the full year. And we would be supportive much more of the Dash 3 amendment that gives a 6-month supply. I have provided written testimony that gives you the reasons why we feel the way we do about the bill. And previously, my peers also communicated their opposition to the bill, which we share that viewpoint as well. And with that, I'll leave it with my written testimony and thank you for your time.
Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly and I'm here in support of the bill as written for the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. The studies that show that it's more effective to have a 12-month supply, making it easier for women to maintain the ability to not become pregnant is important.
costs going up for health care. They will go up if you have unintended consequences. 44% of the births in Oregon are provided by the Oregon Health Plan, and that is a cost to the state. The average cost of birth control ranges $160 to $600 a year. That does not seem out of line. As a former agent, travel agency owner, I should say that I always told my clients to pack all of their medication in travel, in the luggage they took with them, because it was the only way that they could make sure that it would get there with them at the same time. And that's just a precaution that we always use. So problem of storage should not be a problem. And I believe that people could figure out that the bureau drawer in their bedroom would be a rather consistent temperature, not related to cooking temperatures nor moisture, as if in control in the bathroom. We believe this bill is important to the women of Oregon, and we urge your support.
Thank you so much. Mary Nolan, do you wanted to respond 2 minutes?
About a minute and a half. Madam
okay.
Chair. Thank you. I know you have other things, and I appreciate your attention, and I can read the faces and the empty seats to tell me that I better move. Mary Nolan, Interim Executive Director at Planned Parenthood Advocates. Just a couple of quick things that I heard in your earlier testimony. Dr. Frum presented information from the CDC and the Guttmacher Institute making a public health and medical case for 12-month dispensing. I didn't hear any testimony from the previous panel to provide any medical research that would make a case for a different level, specifically for the 6-month level. I assume that that's because they don't have medical research or public health studies that would argue in favor of 6 months. We also presented information about the cost savings under a 12-month dispensing policy. Again, I didn't hear any information or tests or research that was proposed, presented by the other side, arguing in favor of 6 months. So we've given you information for a medical case, public health, and cost savings for 12 months, and there seems to be a lack of evidence arguing for a different level, specifically 6 months. Nothing in the bill before you would require an insurer to pay for more than 12 months of contraception in any 12-month period. So, for example, if a patient lost the medicine, there is nothing in this bill that requires the insurer to replace that. And finally, as Ms. Earls commented, their concerns are not necessarily, I'm not getting this exactly right, but she said their concerns are not necessarily about contraception, but about other prescription medicine. And I would just remind the committee that the bill in front of you is exclusively about contraception. The policy you have in front of you is about dispensing of contraceptives. And if people want to have a discussion or debate about other prescription drugs, that's not what's in front of you today. The bill is very limited to contraception, and it sounded, in fact, to me like the insurers were very supportive of extending coverage and dispensing of contraceptives. So we urge you to pass House Bill 3343A as it came to you from the House.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Right. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3343 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2758.
Zena. Madam Chair, House Bill 2758 prohibits carriers and third-party administrators from disclosing to anyone other than the enrollee receiving services personal information about an enrollee upon the request of the dependent enrollee. It specifies procedures for enrollees making a confidential communication request. It changes the definition of personal health information to protected health information. It protects confidential communication and appeal of adverse benefits determination. There's dash A11 amendment, which defines enrollees as someone 18 years of age or older. There's no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
Senator Burdick.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson and Vice Chair Cruz. For the record, my name is Ginny Burdick, and I represent the people of Senate District 18, West Portland, and Tigard. I'm here today as the chief sponsor of House Bill 2758 with my colleague, Representative Williamson from the House. And this bill would protect patient privacy in insurance communications. Confidentiality plays a fundamental role in ensuring that everyone has access to health care services. House Bill 2758 seeks to close one of the last remaining loopholes in patient privacy by allowing patients to have insurance communications sent directly to the member receiving services, even if they are not the primary insurance policyholder. Currently, insurance companies send out an explanation of benefit to the primary policyholder after a doctor's visit. This statement can include sensitive details and information that the patient might, for many reasons, want to keep private. We do not want Oregonians who need medical care foregoing that care because they are worried about who might find out about their doctor visit. Without clear confidentiality protections, individuals may be unwilling to share information about the context or causes of conditions with their health care provider, which could result in incorrect diagnoses and missed opportunities for prevention. And this is another important point, and that is that this lack of confidentiality can also endanger domestic violence survivors who may be unaware that the policyholder will be informed that they've sought services. For example, the explanation of benefits will often contain information that can be used to locate a survivor. There is a lot of information and confusion about this bill, so I want to just tell you a few things that it does not do. It does not impact minor consent statutes in Oregon. Insurance companies are sent, insurance communications are sent after a medical visit has already taken place. House Bill 2758 affects only those insurance communications that follow a visit and therefore has no impact on what services can be provided to minors. Oregon law is explicit about age of consent for medical services for minors. The services minors can consent are defined in statute and include dental health, mental health, and others. These have been carefully considered by the medical community excuse me, and the legislature excuse me, to ensure that minors do not face unnecessary barriers to the health care.
I have a cough drop. Do you want it?
My deepest apologies.
You should be home. I'm a nurse. You need to listen to me.
Actually, Madam Chair, I think she's got some fun planned for a little later. So.
This is deeply embarrassing. I apologize. This is a good bill, should pass. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Senator Burdick. Lorena Reynolds, Sarah Keefe, and Nicoletta McKee. Oh, is Representative Hack here?
Ma'am.
Come. You know, I haven't met you.
Hello.
Yes, so welcome.
You can come too, I don't mind.
Yeah, well, two of you can sit there. Yeah.
That's great.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jody Hack, and I represent House District 19. And I am here today to visit with you about House Bill 2758. I'm actually in opposition of this bill. My concern about this bill is that it takes away the rights of parents to know what's happening with their children as it relates to health care. And you're going to hear probably some differing opinions about that today. But I want to tell you a little bit about an incident that I personally was involved in. I've coached for over 12 years, all different age groups, from little guys all the way up into high school and all the way through college, and had a 15-year-old girl from a very nice family who was dating a young man and went to the doctor, and he paid for the copay, took her to the doctor, and she had contracted an STD. He paid for the prescription, and nothing was said
until the explanation of benefits came home to her parents. Her parents sat down with her and said, hey, it looks like you'd been to the doctor, and started a dialogue with her. Come to find out, she was in a severely abusive relationship with a young man, and no one knew. And had that dialogue not occurred between this young girl and her parents, she didn't say anything to the doctor. The outcome for this young girl could have been extremely different. So what I'd like to challenge you with as a committee is to think about, you're going to hear all kinds of stories we did on the floor of different scenarios of why this bill is important. But I think for me, when I heard about it, I was compelled to stand up and talk and tell this story, because I think it's important for us to think about all of the victims, and is one victim less important than another? And had this situation not been able to occur, the outcome of this young woman certainly would have been much different. And we have conversations all the time about different bills and things since I've been here, about parents needing to have a say in what happens with their children, right down to assessment of testing in schools. And we just did a bill on our side about the fact that parents should have choice in whether or not their children should take a test in school. Yet now we introduce a bill that says they shouldn't have a say in knowing what is happening to their children, whether or not they see a physician. Now, I know not all parents are great parents. I get that. But again, what victim is less important than another? And had there been an amendment to this bill that said 18 years and older, when your kids go off to college and they don't want their parents to know some of these things, maybe it would have been a little bit different. But when you sign your child up for sports, you sign a consent that says, if my child is hurt, they can be treated. That's a whole nother concept I'd like you to consider too, in addition to the true story that actually happened, that if you thought about that, what if that was your daughter? I happened to hear about that because I was a coach. But in addition to that, being a coach, we have had controversy after controversy over the concussion issue. I know how much kids want to participate. I saw it firsthand. And to say that we're going to put that in the hands of a child to make the decision whether or not they can or can't participate, because they can now go to the physician, see the physician, tell the physician, I don't want that sent home to mom and dad. The information doesn't go home to mom and dad. They continue to play. They've got a concussion. The coach doesn't know. The parents don't know. We've now left that in the hands of a 15-year-old kid to decide whether or not they're going to continue to play football, or a 16-year-old kid, or volleyball, or whatever it is, to say, okay, you can make that decision for yourself. They don't want to let their teammates down. They're headed to the state playoffs. I've seen it happen. There are some kids, if the parent doesn't intervene and say, you're done, they don't stop. So again, we're saying you're going to leave that decision up to a child to decide, and you're going to take that away from a parent. Mm-hmm. Again, I know they're not all great parents out there. I get that. But at what point do we say those victims are less important than the other? Mm-hmm. The other part we're going to hear about is that it relates to victims in abuse, and that they shouldn't, that they don't want to send this information because they're being abused and they don't want the information to go to their abuser. Under federal law, Obamacare already covers that. Women can say, or men can say, I don't want this sent home to my abuser. It's already there. So I would caution you greatly in moving this bill out of your committee and onto your floor, unless there's an amendment to it and there's some work done on it. And we certainly hope that you would take the time to do that. As a parent, I am so disheartened by this bill that we can say that parents should have a choice, and is something as small as an assessment in school, but we can't have a choice in healthcare for our kids, and all the reasons I've stated. So please take the time to go through this and take a hard, hard look at it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Madam Chair, members of the committee, My name is Sarah Keefe, and I'm Health Systems Coordinator at the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. And I'm here on behalf of the coalition and our 50-member programs, which are all of Oregon's domestic and sexual violence programs, in strong support of this bill. Much respect to the testimony with this survivor story, and I think it speaks to the complexity of these systems, but we're here in support of this bill because we believe it's a needed change to better provide access to supportive services for all survivors of domestic violence. It's addressing an important loophole for survivors of domestic violence accessing necessary health care. We see this in a few settings. One in particular is when a survivor is leaving her abusive partner. An explanation of benefits letter can be used to track down her or her children if they access care. This is so important because survivors of domestic violence, one out of four American women, will have been in a physical or sexually abusive relationship at some point in her life. This has immediate health effects. U.S. Department of Justice studies showed that 37% of all women who sought care in emergency rooms for violence-related injuries were injured by a current or former spouse. We know that homicide by intimate partner is the number one cause of death for pregnant and postpartum women. In addition to this immediate harm, we know that survivors of domestic violence experience an 80% more likely chance of having a stroke. They're 70% more likely to have heart disease. They're 60% more likely to have asthma and 70% more likely to drink heavily than women who have not experienced domestic violence. The effects of domestic violence on a survivor, both immediate as well as long-term, highlight the importance of connecting survivors to care. And right now, my member programs hesitate to connect survivors to care because they're afraid of these gaps in confidentiality that we currently face with the medical care system around explanations of benefits letters, both with survivors who have fled their situation and moved to a new community, but also with the Affordable Care Act, making screening and counseling for domestic violence one of the core women's health services, which is wonderful. It's going to help healthcare systems help survivors, but that's going to lead to an increase in billing for domestic violence screening and counseling. And if that ends up on an explanation of benefits letter and goes home to the abusive partner and they know that that survivor is reaching out for help, that could escalate the violence. And we've seen that time and time again. So it's complex, and I really appreciate the different stories that are being shared. But from the domestic and sexual violence community, we do strongly support this bill to fix this loophole, so we can recommend to all advocates and survivors that they can partner with their healthcare providers to make sure women can be safe. Thank you.
Thank you. Lorena Reynolds testifying in favor of the bill. Chair Moan Anderson and members of the committee. I am an attorney in private practice in Corvallis who specializes in family law. I've handled many, many cases involving intimate violence. Because of my experience working with survivors of domestic violence, sexual assault, sexual abuse, and stalking, I support this bill to increase safety for survivors of violence and allow them greater access to services. This bill will strengthen privacy for survivors who seek services relating to their abuse. Many survivors have health insurance that is provided to them through the employment of a family member. Sometimes this is the very person who has abused them. Other times it is a parent, step-parent, or spouse who is unaware of the abuse and who the survivor may not want to know of the abuse. As it stands now, whenever a survivor seeks mental health or medical care, the explanation of benefit statement is sent to the person who holds the insurance policy, not to the person seeking services. This has at least two negative effects. First, survivors who are aware that the policy holder will be informed that they're seeking services sometimes do not seek those services. If a woman has contracted a sexually transmitted infection or is pregnant as a result of being assaulted, she may delay obtaining prenatal care. Teenagers and young adults may choose not to seek medical care or see a counselor because they don't want their parent, step-parent, or guardian to know of the abuse. Someone assaulted by a spouse who holds the insurance may not go to the emergency room or urgent care for treatment of injuries because they fear further abuse by their spouse when the EOB arrives and when the abuser finds out that they sought medical care. Second, the lack of confidentiality endangers survivors who are unaware that the policyholder will be informed that they sought services. EOBs contain information that can be used to locate survivors. For example, if a survivor regularly sees a counselor each week, the policyholder can see this pattern on their EOB. For survivors in hiding, this is a barrier to accessing services. It is also common for abusers to then use this information to try to access additional information from the counselors, to harass the counselors, or to even intercept a survivor on her way to her appointment with her providers. I have personally been involved in cases where a child was in counseling as the result of the abuse by a parent who then received information about the counseling services from their EOBs, including treatment codes and information about the child's diagnosis, even though that parent was prohibited from court order from having any contact with the child or accessing any of the child's records. We were unsuccessful in being able to try to get the insurance company to send those EOBs to another's location. House Bill 2758 will require carriers to send insurance communications directly to the member rather than to the primary policyholder. As we move forward with healthcare reform and the digitalization of medical information, it is critical to remember that for many insured patients, lack of confidentiality protections is the same as lack of insurance. Thank you very much for your time.
I think it's important to say that if a patient asks to not have their information sent to the policy person, that every carrier has an 800 number,
right.
An 800 number that they should be able to contact them, because I think it's and the insurers will come up here, but I think it's a breach, a privacy breach, if a patient request this.
Madam Chair, if I may.
Yes.
We actually pointed that out on the floor during our debate, that it is in rule under Obamacare, it is in rule that if they are being treated for domestic violence, sexual abuse, anything like that, and you say, I do not want my records to go, it is in rule that they cannot be sent.
So we'll have the, but that's all right.
You're also making the assumption that somebody is a sophisticated user who's going to be able to ask that, who's going to understand how EOBs work, and who's going to have the resources and wherewithal to be able to make that call. For many women in crisis, that is not the situation.
Okay. Hold it. We will be having the carriers up to discuss this. I am very in favor of the bill. That's not the point. I just wanted to make sure that I put that on the record that HIPAA is really.
Madam Chair.
Okay, and then let's call up are you Nicoletta?
I am.
Okay, and then James Barton and Marcia Kelly. And let's try to keep the testimony to two minutes.
Yeah.
Unless it's very different from what's already been said.
Madam Chair and members of the Senate Healthcare Committee, my name is Nicoletta McKee, and I'm here to speak in support of House Bill 2758. As the call center manager for Planned Parenthood Columbia Willamette, I oversee a staff that fields an average of 600 calls every day from patients across Oregon and Southwest Washington. These patients are relying on us to provide them with accurate information and non-judgmental counseling, but more than anything, people of all ages come to us because they know they'll be cared for compassionately and confidentially. Planned Parenthood Columbia Willamette replaces fear with facts, misinformation with education, and we're here to protect public health by preventing unintended pregnancy and sexually transmitted diseases. We're here to provide life-saving cancer screenings for women with nowhere else to turn, and we're here for teens who don't know how to talk to their parents about sexual health. The Affordable Care Act has achieved great strides in making health insurance more affordable for thousands of Oregonians who are uninsured, particularly for those younger than 26 who can stay on their parents' health insurance plans. However, it has increased concerns about major loopholes in privacy when it comes to insurance companies, this major loophole in particular. If people are afraid of using their health insurance because their confidentiality will be violated, they're effectively uninsured. The call center recently received a call from a 16-year-old who needed treatment for the removal of genital warts. Even though she had private insurance through her parents, she didn't even consider it as an option for fear that they would find out. This is a fairly expensive treatment, and you know, she was desperately trying to scrape together the money to pay for her healthcare services out of her own pocket, and this is unacceptable. You know, we also hear from survivors of domestic violence who need to gain access to birth control or STD testing while trying to escape an unsafe situation. At such a vulnerable time, the last thing they need to worry about is the danger of their partner discovering when and where they're seeking healthcare services. We ask that you please support House Bill 27558 to protect the privacy of patients in their insurance communications.
Thank you
so much.
You came under 3 minutes. Great.
Chair Monis Anderson, other member of the committee. My name is James Barda. I'm the legislative director for Children First for Oregon, where we work to make Oregon the very best place to be a kid. And there's been a lot of discussion about how the bill will affect adults. We're here to talk about how it does affect teenagers. And the compelling testimony we heard earlier from the representative is important to keep in mind, partially because the example is the person, you know, the girl went to the doctor. And I think what we need to emphasize is this bill will help encourage everyone to go to the doctor. Now, you know, no situation is going to be perfect, but in this case, we're also talking about more than 800 cases of abuse of 15 to 17-year-olds in this state. That places Oregon in the top third in the country. And it's important that they are encouraged to go to the doctor, just as, you know, for other medical reasons, as the previous person testified. People are concerned about parents finding out, and at least they're seeing a professional. At the very least, there's a chance that if there's some other problem in a relationship or whatever, that they will be in a professional setting and have an opportunity to discuss whatever's going on. And so in the case of these abused children, they need to know that they can get testimony without having the family situation home, which may be abusive, having another reason to be upset with them. So that's why Children First urges your support for this legislation as is.
Thank you.
Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly with the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. Make it very short. People deserve privacy in their health care decisions. This includes people who are on other people's policies. Healthy relationships almost always allow parents and children to share information. It's those unhealthy relationships where the children can face reprisal that this bill would cover for minors. The abuse situation is also a concern, and I think that is a very real concern, having dealt with a young woman who was getting no support from her family. She was newly married in an abusive situation and wanted to run out of the country in order to get away and talk to the family, her family, and they just said, "You're married, you have to deal with it." And those things can happen. This girl got away because I called the crisis service, but she would have not known that she could go to counseling unless I would have told her, because it was not a healthy situation with parents.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Madam Chair, so a couple people have testified that this is there's federal rule as it relates to this. So my question to all of you is how does this bill change that? If they can already do that, if they can already have an EOB sent somewhere else, if they're a victim of abuse, how does this bill change that process?
Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Knopp, not all people are going to go to their physician for services as a result of abuse. And having that as the only reason why that could be done is not acceptable.
I think that we'll have Planned Parenthood come up to answer that specific question, if that would be all right. And so thank you very much, panel. And who is going to speak for Planned Parenthood? Okay, Mary Nolan. And then, Marty Hayen and Elizabeth Ramley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chairman Sanderson, Senator Knoop, Mary Nolan, Interim Executive Director with Planned Parenthood Advocates of Oregon. I want to speak specifically to the issue of federal rule and proposed Oregon statute. First of all, that's one of the distinctions. Federal rule is federal rule. While it has authority, it is in rule, not in statute. We are asking that the women and patients of Oregon be protected by statute, which is a stronger protection. More importantly, the federal rule only applies to certain circumstances, not to all health care. So a person has to identify as being abused or in a dangerous or unsafe circumstance. The bill we're recommending here is for all medical care for which the patient is allowed to give medical consent. So you don't have to identify as being abused, although it would apply and be a comfort and a security for people who are in a situation that they consider dangerous. It would also protect people who wouldn't identify themselves as being in physical or emotional jeopardy. And finally, as I say, the federal rule allows the patient to request it, but it does not require that the insurer meet the request. There is no enforcement mechanism. We're delighted to hear from insurers here in Oregon who are complying with it, and we applaud their effort. But we think that protections should be enforceable.
Thank you very much.
So further question for Mary. So Mary, where's the parents' role in these healthcare decisions with kids that are under 18 that aren't in abusive relationships, or their parent isn't the abuser? Because this seems like kind of a full frontal assault on parental rights.
Chair Mona Sanderson and Senator Knoop, I would actually refer back to what my senator said when she introduced this bill. Senator Burdick pointed out that this bill doesn't change anything about medical consent. Explanations of benefit are pieces of paper that are sent after medical treatment is delivered. Oregon has statutes defining age of medical consent that differ by the type of service. But to your broader question, I certainly would agree with the implication you're making that parents should be involved in healthcare choices and services that their children receive. And I certainly wanted to provide that for my daughter as she was growing up. She's now over 18, so it's not an issue. But if that can't happen, you asked about parents where that can happen. Nothing in this bill would change or disrupt that relationship, because if there is an open communication, the child is likely to go to the physician or nurse with the parent. If that doesn't happen, for kids who can't do that, it still allows them to safely access the medical care that they need, and that's the purpose of the bill.
A follow-up question? So, Mary, you probably saw the minority report. Where does the minority report fall short, in your opinion?
Chair Mona Sanderson and Senator Knoop. The minority report focused, if I can recall it, and I don't have it in, you're talking about the House minority report.
Right.
It focused on mandatory reporting and making sure that people were authorized to report abuse. But it fell short because it took out
the language that allows the patient and requires the insurer to follow through on the patient's request to provide privacy. From my point of view, where it fell short is it took out the substance of this bill and substituted something that might be good policy, but it took out the things that I think are important to protect. The protections are not only for people who are minors, but as others have testified, this goes to spouses who might be seeking mental health services and are not quite ready to share that with their spouse. Kids who are 25 and a half, 26 years old and still on their parents' policy and maybe don't want to talk with mom and dad about anything from breaking an arm and worrying them to other issues that they're being treated for. The bill protects all those patients.
I think that's kind of my point, is that you end up with a bipartisan bill if you're focusing on people that are 18 years and old or older, because I readily agree with you that adult kids, I'm going to have a married son here in a little over a month, and he'll be on my policy. And I don't have any reason to want to know about his health care, really. So that actually makes a lot of sense to me. What makes no sense to me is that kids that are under 18 who parents are responsible for are going to be able to essentially collude with medical professionals even though they don't have an issue of a threat or anything else. And there's lots of things that kids like to hide from their parents. I don't think we should be making it easier for people to get involved in that relationship where those communications need to happen between kids and parents when there isn't cases of abuse or something pretty serious of that nature.
Chair Monis-Anderson and Senator Knope, first of all, congratulations. I hope you're able to get to the wedding and that the legislature's adjourned by then.
You could talk to Senator Courtney about that. That'd be awesome.
I suspect he hopes you can get to your son's wedding as well. It seems to me that you are raising questions about the underlying and separate statute about medical consent. We are not bringing you a bill that relates to medical consent, and that discussion may be something that the committee should have, but that's not the subject of this bill. This bill is about insurance information that overrides the privacy that the provider wants to give to the patient. And under age of medical consent, when it relates to a patient under the age of 18, the law allows a healthcare provider to deliver services on the say-so of the patient, but it does not require it. And medical providers routinely assess whether it is in the best interest of that patient, with the information that that patient shares with the provider, whether to proceed with providing that service to the patient on the patient's own request. Nothing here changes that. What we're simply saying is that if the provider, the physician, the nurse practitioner, whoever it is, makes the judgment that delivering that service is in the best interest of their patient, we don't think an insurance communication should override that decision.
Follow-up. So it sounds like that Planned Parenthood's position basically is that they want, as a provider, as a medical provider, they want to be able to not have to have that communication, if that's their decision, to counsel the patient not to have those medical benefits sent home. Is that what is that understanding correct from what you just said?
Chair Monis-Anderson and Senator Knope, I don't think so. And if that's the case, I'm sorry if I misspoke. Planned Parenthood wants to respect the wishes of the patient. We don't want to guide a patient one way or another.
So follow up. So I understand the issue of medical consent, but my point was is that the explanation of benefits that get sent later, when the parent is responsible for that child if they're under 18, is something that's going to start a dialogue, assuming that there isn't an abuse situation where it does need to go somewhere else. And it seems like those children should probably be in another setting and not be near those abusers. But that said, it seems to me like that this bill is overly broad in that sense, that it easily cuts the parents out of those healthcare discussions that they can have with their children, including the instance of Representative Hack, where it sounds like maybe a young girl was probably saved from significant abuse because of that discussion.
Chair Monis-Anderson and Senator Knoop, I have heard the story that Representative Hack conveyed on the House floor, and then I heard it again today. And I am glad that that young woman received help both in the initial medical appointment where she received care and in the support and guidance and love that her parents extended to her after learning that. There's nothing in this bill that that tells a parent that they can't support their child. There's nothing in this bill that says communication can't happen between a child and a parent, but it says that we value access to medical care and are willing to rely, as current Oregon statute does, on the judgment of the healthcare provider about whether their patient might be at risk and able to consent knowledgeably to their own medical care.
So follow up. So in that particular situation, though, it sounded to me like that girl in that abusive relationship would probably have taken up the provider on that, because she was obviously hiding the abuse from her parents. And so in that particular case, the parents wouldn't be any the wiser, and they may have ended up with a dead daughter. Who knows? And so that's what I'm talking about, is that for kids under 18, again, making sure that discussion takes place, I think, is as important to the patient as the health care that they're getting, because in her case, it sounded like that the abuse would have continued had her parents not been able to step in, because they were essentially tipped off by the explanation of benefits.
Chair Monis-Anderson and Senator Knoop, I don't want to sit here and try to balance one circumstance against another and try to say that one potential victim is more important than another potential victim. I think, Senator, though, we can't sit here in this room and decide or legislate what the best course for every single circumstance is, which is why over the years Oregon has established the medical consent and the advisory responsibility on providers the way it has. And the information might have helped that young woman. The information could have gotten to her parents some way other than the EOB. There are other instances where the information actually does create a risk and, in fact, a cause of injury to the patient. So I can't put myself in a position of trying to say this one is more important than that one.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senators. My name is Marty Hyen, and I live here in Salem, Oregon. This bill, when it is applied to people over the age of 18, I'm totally in favor of it.
but as written, since it applies to minors, I am not. As a parent of a 16-year-old, I am very much against how it is currently written. Am I going to be expected to pay for a bill of some sort of secret procedure that I have no knowledge of and would not approve of? Could my child die because of a secret procedure that I'm not aware of? A teen should not have the right to complete privacy from their parents. Their parents are morally, legally, and financially responsible for them. A 16-year-old cannot vote. They cannot enter into a contract. They cannot marry without consent. They cannot fight in the armed services. They can't have consensual sex with a 20-year-old because then they would be a victim of rape. They're not old enough to smoke or drink alcohol. Yet Oregon deems them old enough to be in charge of their own health care. And you deem them old enough to exclude their parents, the people who are responsible for them, the people who love them like no other. As a 16-year-old that was pregnant, I know that kids will do whatever they can to hide something from their parents, whether they are afraid of punishment, disappointing their parents. Hiding a medical issue is not in their best long-term interest, although it may seem like the only solution to them at the time. But as a teen, they don't have the ability to discern this. They're only looking at the now. They're not looking at the long-term effects that a parent with years of wisdom from life experience will look at that whole process. It's time to stop eroding the rights and responsibilities of Oregon parents. Now, I understand that this law does not preclude teenagers from seeking medical assistance on their own. But that piece of paper could give the important clue to the parents that something's going on, that their teen is hiding, something that could be life-threatening if they're not able to participate in that. So I would ask you to amend the bill to make it for 18 and older or vote no. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson with Providence Health and Services, and thank you so much for the opportunity to talk on yet another bill today. We are here in support of House Bill 2758, and want to thank the proponents for what was a very collaborative and lengthy process to reach this point, and particularly Emily McLean, who spent hours with Elizabeth Remley and myself working out this bill and really making it something that we could implement. For us as both a provider and a payer, as we look at this bill, while it does, as the proponents have identified, take federal rule and put it in Oregon statute, it does expand the number of, or really any condition for which a patient wishes to redirect their explanation of benefits, and that will frankly make it easier as an insurer to be able to do that, so we don't have to try and discern one way or another whether that patient or that enrollee is or is not in danger or in a domestic violence situation. So this improves current federal rule in that regard. As a provider, we would say that for us, the most important thing is that our patients get access to the care they need when they need it. And so if there is, if pieces of paper are a barrier to them receiving the treatment that they need at the time they need it, then we want to make sure that that does not become a reason that people don't seek care. Because often, whether it's a mental health issue or a pregnancy issue or whatever it is, alcohol and drug, or folks are in a place where they need care and they don't want somebody to know about it, and they're paying their co-pays up front, we think that it's important that they get that access in a timely way. So for all of those reasons, we're here to support the bill and encourage it to be moved forward.
Thank you. Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, I am Elizabeth Remley here today on behalf of Cambia Health Solutions, which is the parent company for Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield. I want to echo Jessica's comments. We are here in support of the bill after a significant collaborative process on the House side where we got the bill to a place where it's simple for the patients to access and simple for us to administer. We have currently we have a similar process in place to redirect these explanation of benefits, but this bill sets in place a consistent standard across all carriers and across for every patient to access in the exact same way so that there's consistency and no one's caught off guard by a process or hoops to jump through in order to have this happen for them. And so we want to urge your support of House Bill 2758, and we're glad to be able to come to a consensus on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? All right, I don't have anyone else signed up to testify. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2758, and we're adjourned.
Oh, so you need to caucus.